standing by, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us Mr. Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of the event. I advise you that this webinar is being recorded today. We now pass the floor to Mr. Bornozis. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good morning to everyone, and welcome to Capital Link's webinar series. I am Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, and today's webinar will be a roundtable discussion on the topic of coronavirus and its effects on shipping and trading. I am delighted, actually I'm thrilled, that we have well over 500 participants online. Actually, I think the tally at this moment is 542. So this is a great webinar in terms of attendance, and we have with us industry leaders who are going to tackle the topic we are about to discuss. Moderating the discussion is Hamish Norton, President of Star Bulk Carriers Corporation. And our featured panelists are Joe Hughes, Chairman and CEO of the American Club, Giovanni G. Garavano, Co-CEO of IFCOR, Fabrizio Barcellona, Assistant Secretary of ITF Seafarers, Peter Glover, a partner and master mariner of Reed Smith Richards and Butler. Peter is dialing in from Hong Kong, actually, at this moment. Dora Mays Kokota, partner at Stevenson Cargwood in London. This event is accessible through a live audio webcast and then as an audio archive through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. I'd like to make a brief statement. There have been so many webinars on coronavirus. I think our webinar is completely different. We take the Hamish, who is the president of a major ship owning and ship operator. He's taking the, he's going to be the one asking the questions. So his questions will be, from the ship owner and ship operator point of view, he has a number of practical issues that he wants to address to our experts to find out how a ship owner can navigate through the current environment. So it's a very practical webinar on specific topics, and I'm delighted for the big response. So after the discussion, there will be a Q&A session. Webinar participants can submit, as you can see, questions through the sidebar on the presentation page. We have a box there titled Submit a Question, or you can email your questions to us at questions@capitallink.com. Your questions can be submitted at any point of time, and they will be addressed during the Q&A session. I'd like to mention before closing that the discussions and opinions expressed by the panelists are not intended as legal or investment advice or as advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and of course, Capital Link bears no responsibility for that. Furthermore, the panel discussion may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. As we know, Capital Link has made a strategic commitment to the shipping and maritime industries. In addition to our annual conferences and weekly shipping newsletter, we hold, as you can see, industry webinars on a regular basis. To access our webinar library for past and upcoming webinars, please visit webinars.capitallink.com. And finally, please save the date for our 14th annual Capital Link International Shipping Forum on Monday, March 30, 2020. At the Metropolitan Club in New York City. We're organizing this forum in partnership with the city. And thank you again all for participating. I will turn the floor to Hamish. Hamish, the floor is yours.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are. I thought we would start the panel with a commercial question for Giovanni Ravano of IFCOR. Mr. Ravano, so how much, in your view, is the reduction in charter activity to China, or how much reduction in charter activity to China, if any, seems to be the result of the virus we're now calling COVID-19 as opposed to normal seasonal weakness?
Well, the answer is not obviously that easy. If you look at the quarter, it's usually a very weak quarter with a lot of setbacks on several floors, be it for safety, for maintenance, or for the way the crop cycles are for agris. The reduction, looking at the average of estimates, is ranging between 1% and 2% on the industrial output domestically. I don't think the trade flows, looking at the spot markets of February, have been yet impacted to that effect, with diversion of ships or people not shipping into China. But clearly, looking at the consumption in the country, the impact on production, the slowdown is real, and the effect, I think, will be felt in the coming months, and it will be in effect until the situation persists. Yet, I would say industrially, 1 to 2% seems to be pretty much the estimated of the impact. On the agri side, I think it's a very different situation. The animals need to be fed. There is very little variety or deviance from the normal pattern. It's very hard to change formulations for animals. And because of China is very dependent on protein imports in the form of soybeans, it's virtually impossible they have another source to replace that. So I suspect on the soybean flows, granted that's part of a larger conversation around the trade war between China and the U.S., I don't think we can see a lot of disruptions on those flows. So overall, the impact, I would say, is relatively benign yet. And obviously, depending on the duration and how fast the solution can be found, that will then rolls on the months to come.
Okay, thank you very much. And now a couple of questions for Fabrizio Barcellona of the ITF. And Mr. Barcellona, what are the obligations of a ship owner towards the crew in case the ship is scheduled to visit a port which is affected by COVID-19? And what are the obligations of a ship owner toward crew who have already contracted the COVID-19 virus? Is Mr. Barcellona not on?
Hello?
Oh, hi. Fabrizio?
Yeah, I'm on.
Yeah, sorry. Did you hear my question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Amish. No, I was saying that if you don't mind, we refer to the Maritime Labor Convention, which is often used as assisting when it comes to seafarers' matter, as an international instrument that has been designed to look at the human factor in shipping. And the, particularly the Article 5 of the Convention states that every seafarer has a right to health protection, medical care, and other welfare measures. So the obligation in our opinion, the way we see it, is certainly for a ship owner to provide advice to the seafarers based on the advice provided by the WHO, for example, and make sure that they have every protecting measure before going to a port. But not only that, we think that there are some arguments by which maybe the seafarers have the right not to proceed with the ship in a port that has been declared at risk of coronavirus. That is based on the fact that if authority prevent foreigner to come in by air, by road, by train, then we don't see why the seafarer should be treated in a different way. There are other provision within the Maritime Labor Convention that I'm sure most of the people in the panel and those listening to the webinar are aware of, the right for repatriation for justified reason and so forth and so on. We think that there is potentially a risk, for example, if I may, for a ship going in a port where inevitably the seafarers will come into contact with shore people and then might contract coronavirus. Now, the ship leaving for a long voyage back, let's put an example, going back to Brazil, a bulk carrier after unloading in China via Good Hope, and if the seafarers on board has contracted the coronavirus, then what? We have assisted in the few days ago a cruise vessel that's been denied access to many ports until finally Cambodia allowed the ship to go in. And we think that the obligation, of course, for a ship owner should be immediately alert authority, but then we fear that might be some countries might refuse access to the ships and just put in quarantine, that potentially affecting all the rest of the crew. I think that there is also something that we look in terms of negligence, although I'm not a lawyer and there are more people on this panel that are more expert than me when it comes to legal matter, but a ship owner deliberately going to a port where there is a serious risk of contracting coronavirus, in our opinion, expose unnecessarily seafarers to this risk.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Barcelona. So now I guess a question for the lawyers, and I think Ms. Mace Cocotta and Mr. Glover may have spoken to try to divide up the questions, but you know, so for the lawyers, who would bear the cost in a typical time charter or a voyage charter if the ship is required to wait outside the discharge port due to COVID-19 in the port? I guess the flip side of that is, who would bear the cost if the ship is required to wait in quarantine after having called at a port where COVID-19 was found?
I'm happy to take the lead on this one, and I'll ask Dora to contribute as we go through, if that's okay. If we take the voyage charter as being the starting point, and then we'll move on to time charters. If we take the voyage charter, if you're looking at the ship being required to wait outside the discharge port due to COVID-19 in the port, well, the first thing that, to my mind, turns on is whether there has been a notice of readiness issued under the voyage charter. So that's the starting point. Then we drill into the detail. We need to have a look at what the notice of readiness provisions are within the charter party. It should be borne in mind that at common law, free pratique, which is going to be tied to the COVID-19, or should be tied to it, doesn't exist. So you've got to look at the contractual provisions within the charter party. But if the ship has arrived and it's given notice of readiness, then the risk is going to be on the charterer. But if it hasn't been able to give notice of readiness in its accordance with the contractual provisions found within the voyage charter, the risk is going to be on the owner. That said, we use the terms voyage charter and time charter, and I appreciate you said, you know, typical time charters and typical voyage charters. You always need to look at what the contract is. It's sometimes a bit of a mistake to look at the title. So it all comes back to what the contractual wording is. But that would be the basic division of risk if you're looking at having to wait outside as a result of COVID-19. You fall back onto the notice of readiness. It's in many respects a lot simpler when you look at the time charter. Again, what you're looking at is assessing the language of the time charter, interpreting that, but in broad summary terms, the risk is going to be on the time charterer themselves and not the owner. Now,
and
that is warranty? That is on the basis that the vessel is fit in all respects to perform the service that is actually required of the vessel. Now, the complicating factor on top of all this is whether the port is safe or not, and that's a separate question again. What we're looking at there is responding to the question if it has to wait outside for COVID-19, which is separate again to if the port is safe or not. Dora, I'm not sure if you've got anything you'd like to contribute to on top of that.
No, I think that was all. I think just to stress that obviously, which is something that we discussed as well, Peter, is that we need to be very careful, and perhaps at this stage it is worth doing some due diligence for anybody and everybody that is concerned about their charters and checking the particular language, because as Peter stressed, although we do have typical forms that people use in the market, every clause that we come across it is different, and therefore it needs a very very careful look and breakdown in order to understand the language and its implications.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, similar question, I guess, you know, what happens if the vessel comes to the next port and is quarantined as a result of having called at a port affected by COVID-19? You know,
if it's been quarantined, again, you've got to look at what the division is between time and voyage charters, but it raises a number of interesting legal consequences. So if we look at the example of a voyage charter and you've been quarantined in a secondary port, again, the vessel is on hire. You have to look at any provision in there which would potentially take the vessel off hire, but the risk is going to fall with the voyage charterer. There are secondary consequences which could flow from that. If it's quarantined, you might find that in addition to the vessel being detained, you end up with potentially an unseaworthy vessel and issues of unsafe port on the basis of the vessel becoming unseaworthy. So it can be quite a complex legal position that you find yourself in. But it's also going to be very, very factually dependent, and we're very careful about making too much in way of sweeping statements.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Mr. Barcelona pointed out that at least in his view, there would be circumstances where a crew could refuse to enter a port with COVID-19 if they thought it wasn't safe to do so. And what would be the consequences in a typical time charter or a typical voyage charter if the crew refused to enter such a port?
I appreciate this is probably a very relevant question in light of many of the crews looking at the current press coverage. And it's available, for example, on the internet today. There's crew advertising themselves from various cruise ships and pleading for help. So much is going to depend on what refusal to cooperate with an owner's instructions actually amounts to. You may find that there's breach of terms and employment and various conditions that the crew have breached. But looking at the charter performance itself, if we look at a voyage charter, you need to then break it down into the various components. Was this a refusal before the voyage charter was fixed or whether it was after? So you may find, depending on the timing of the refusal, that an owner may breach their, for example, proper manning levels. If, for example, this refusal was before the charter party was entered into, and then you end up with fitness of the vessel, which then could put the owner into breach with his charterer. If you're then looking at the other side of the coin and going to time charter, an owner may be liable for delay if it could be established that it was for want of due diligence to make the vessel seaworthy, or on account of some form of personal act or omission on the part of the owner, if you can trace correspondence between the crew back up to the ownership chain. So again, it's a very complex situation which you could be looking at with numerous legal permutations depending on where the factual matrix collides with the Charter Party and the operative law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move the questions for a moment to Joseph Hughes of the American Club. And question for Mr. Hughes, and this is a pretty open-ended question, but there are obviously many ways for the COVID-19 virus to cause losses to ship owners and charterers, you know, quarantines, medical evacuation expenses, other medical expenses, inability to enter the load or discharge port for all sorts of reasons, and, you know, maybe you can think of other possible loss scenarios associated with COVID-19. You know, I suppose including having ships tied up in repair yards for vastly longer than was anticipated, which I think is in fact happening right now. Which, if any, of these many types of losses would be typically covered by insurance, and which types of losses might not be typically covered but might still possibly be covered if you have the right sort of insurance policy?
Thank you, Hamish. Good question. I think as a general proposition, the COVID-19 outbreak has implications for three areas of mainstream marine insurance. The first area is in relation to regular protection and indemnity or third-party liability effectively cover in regard to people claims, as we sometimes call them, so that medical expenses, compensation for crew and passenger deaths perhaps, repatriation of crew or passengers, diversion expenses to put off crew or passengers who are ill, having been infected by the virus. Those are typical claims that, in the ordinary way, and would be treated the same way, actually, in regard to COVID-19, are covered by P&I clubs. And I don't think that the COVID-19 nature or the circumstances that arise from COVID-19 are any different in substance. They are, I suspect, they may be in scale than those would apply to the coverage of liabilities arising from those circumstances, from the illness or illness and death of passengers through any other cause. There are also quarantine expenses that may be picked up by a P&I club. They're relatively rare. I've been in the business for many years, and I can't easily recall claims for quarantine as such, but they are certainly a traditional head of ordinary P&I cover, and they typically cover additional expenses incurred by the owner of a ship as a direct consequence of an outbreak of infectious disease on that ship, and that would include quarantine and disinfection expenses and the net loss. It would have to be the net loss to the owner in respect of the cost of fuel, insurance, wages, stores, provisions, and port charges, and so on, that arose therefrom. And I say neither of these two areas of potential exposure are challenged in substance by the nature of the COVID-19 outbreak, although in terms of the scale, as I said a moment ago, there could obviously be claims arising on a much larger and a much larger scale than would traditionally be the case in the case of infectious disease. The other area, again, typically offered by P&I clubs, is in regard to what's called freight, demurrage, and defense cover, or broadly speaking, the cover for legal expenses arising out of disputes that may arise, such as Peter and Cora have mentioned, as between owners and charterers on issues concerning the interpretation of voyage or time charters and so on. That would be very much, again, a typical FD&D expense that clubs would cover and provide support to their members in respect of. And then the third area, which will vary, I think, in terms of the extent to which owners have actually purchased this sort of cover, is what might broadly be described as business interruption cover. Traditionally, loss of hire, cover that owners often take out in conjunction with a hull and machinery cover, although that's typically predicated upon a casualty to an insured ship. That would mean, in the ordinary way, a sort of physical casualty leading to the vessel being put off hire by virtue of it. But there are broader covers available in the market in regard to business and interruption more generally. But the extent to which individual owners purchase that by comparison with regular P&I will vary a bit. And it may be that loss of profit and other consequences of delay caused by the coronavirus on an outbreak in a particular vessel may be covered within that particular sphere of insurance. But that is dependent very much on the original appetite for a particular owner to take out what, in the ordinary way, but for the coronavirus, might have been regarded as a somewhat remote risk. So there are certainly insurances available for the consequences of these outbreaks. As I say, some of them just part of ordinary P&I and FD&D cover, and some of them perhaps a little bit more exotic in what they are intended to cover, but possibly less extensive in the terms to which covers of those have been taken out by ship owners.
Okay, thank you very much. So now a question for Mr. Ravano or the lawyers, frankly, but has anybody heard of situations where a cargo bound for China is unable to be discharged at the originally named port due to COVID-19?
Michel, Gigot here. I'll start, but of course I'll defer to the legal team, who has probably a better coverage of the topic. But as of now, I can't recall, at least in dry bulk, I can't recall a situation where this has happened yet. It could potentially happen. What I think it is more likely to happen is that there is a disruption in the trade flows. The question before regarding the impact on production and consumption, I just would like to complement it. As much as the impact on paper is estimated to be what I mentioned before, 1 to 2%, I think what is more likely to be seen is disruption on the trade flows where, you know, consumption right now in China slows down. The effect is not felt immediately on the import, but production probably will adjust relatively quickly in light to the lower consumption or the void of consumption in some cases. So what is happening, stocks will pile up and increase. And if the situation lasts longer, you will eventually have disruption because vessel will arrive. You might have a storage issue that's probably more likely for grains than it is for other industrial products, for coal or iron ore. But nonetheless, you may have those disruptions. And if the situation is really severe and persisting, then you will see deviation to other destinations because there's no point in going down. So you will likely see those disruptions, but I'm not sure they will be or necessarily be linked to the virus itself, but more to the disruption of trade flows.
Okay. And I guess now a question for the lawyers that came in from the audience, and it's an interesting question, which is, can a scheduled ship delivery, you know, which basically a transfer of ownership of a ship, can that currently take place in China? You know, I guess that's a question for both the practical issues involved as well as any actual regulatory or legal issues.
I can take that, Peter, if you like, because we had something exactly that happening or trying to happen earlier on this week at Stevenson Harwood, and we had to provide advice across the offices. It was managed in the end, and it was very challenging in terms of the practicalities, as you mentioned, Hamish. And because there were certain things that had to be done in terms of originals and all of that, we ended up using FaceTime and all kinds of other things in order for parties to get together. And in the end, there were several different meetings, and some happened in car parks and other open spaces in order to facilitate this. So from a practical point of view, it is very interesting because it is a very challenging situation at the moment. If we're coming to examine the legal position under the shipbuilding contracts, I think what we are hearing and what we are seeing is a lot of force majeure claims coming from the yards on the basis of the force majeure clauses that are included in the shipbuilding contracts, either for deliveries or for repairs of vessels. And then it's a matter of contract construction. And again, it's about looking at those clauses very closely and in detail in order to determine whether actually this kind of situation is first of all covered by the relevant clauses, but secondly, whether actually the results that are anticipated in those clauses are indeed the ones that are anticipated and therefore triggering the clause. So it is complicated, and I know there's a lot of force majeure language and sort of discussions at the moment, but the clauses have to be looked at very carefully, and I think that perhaps people will be surprised as to how narrow these clauses tend to be, and that you know, they may not be as reliable as people think or may think.
Yeah. Well, so I mean that brings up a question relating to force majeure with respect to a new building contract. I gather that there are a number of new buildings that needed to be delivered by midnight on June 30th in order to be compliant with IMO regulations, because the ships were designed under a previous IMO regulatory regime and would not meet IMO regulations if delivered after July 1st of this year. Do you have any experience or any insight on how typical force majeure provisions in these shipbuilding contracts might interact with the absolute need, I gather, to get such ships delivered by June 30th?
Peter, do you want to take that, or do you want me? I don't mind.
No, I'm happy to start.
Yeah.
I think with force majeure, and there's a degree of overlap in the answers here, but you can see a common theme coming through, is that the first and starting point is that force majeure has no established meaning in English contract law. You need to look at the precise contractual clause and interpret that clause against the wider contract. It's relatively standard practice to name events that will constitute a force majeure event. You also see within force majeure clauses various catch-all provisions, but they normally have to be associated with events that are beyond the party's reasonable control. So again, as Dora was saying, we're looking at contractual construction to trigger a force majeure event in the first place. Now, some force majeure clauses, not all, bear in mind you're looking at naming the type of events in there, will include things like epidemic or pandemic, and potentially language along the lines of any law or any action taken by a government or public authority. And you can just see from the wider press coverage how you might be looking to say, well, can I bring myself within the orbit of the natural meaning of those words? If you can, then you've got the first stage of being able to bring yourself within a force majeure clause and event. Once you've triggered that, you then look at saying, well, what is the effect of this if it's going to delay? Well, the first thing you're looking at is that a force majeure event will suspend performance. So it doesn't absolve immediately anyway, bear in mind it's a contractual construction provision, it just suspends performance. Although it may have included within it a on-notice termination provision if your delay exceeds X number of days, weeks, months, etc. So you then bring this back home to the shipbuilding contract and say, well, what's the effect? So if you're just suspending performance and then you perform at a later date, but that later date results in the ship being delivered after the IMO regulatory change provisions mid-year, the owner is going to end up with a ship which has been delivered but doesn't meet the current IMO criteria, which may prevent the ship from sailing. You then bring yourself into the orbit of breach of contract, and then you'd be asking yourself under the well-known tests of Hadley and Baxendale and saying, well, was this a direct loss or was it an indirect loss, and what was the relevant reams of knowledge between the contracting parties? So again, I appreciate there's no simple answer to this, but chances are you're looking at potentially a damages claim. And potentially, if the on-notice termination provisions were to be triggered, excusing yourself from the contract. That's the way I would see it playing out. I'm not sure if, Dora, if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, no, I think you've covered pretty much all of it, Peter. I think the only other thing that I would say is it's quite interesting. There's quite an interesting point raised by an article that I was reading, and that is that some of these contracts between the yards and the customers are also signed when the repair or the delivery happens. So that causes an interesting discussion, to say the least, as to the legal status of the relationship at this point of time. And in terms of a more technical point, I think obviously turning to the breach, issue that Peter was just mentioning and discussing, it will also depend on exactly what specifications have been set out in the shipbuilding contract, and what exactly is the yard expected to be delivered, as to whether there is damages or something beyond that.
And now an interesting question has come in from the audience for Fabrizio Barcellona of ITF. It's two questions. One is the ITF aware of any crew on a non-cruise ship at sea right now being infected by the COVID-19 virus? And second question is, how should crew changeovers be handled if they were previously scheduled to be done via China and the crew do not want to go through China, or are not allowed, in fact, maybe to go through China?
Thank you, Hamish. At the moment, no, we are not aware of any seafarers or non-cruise ships being infected, but we are receiving daily, and I would say just last week, probably we received around 800 direct requests from seafarers that were concerned about their health because they have either been in China or in a country where the coronavirus is quite the outbreak is higher than others. For the second question, I think that not 100% sure that there's been a situation where the seafarers themselves have been
Hello.
I think we may have lost Mr. Barcellona. Well, we can come back to him when mm-hmm. he's hooked back up. So then a question for the lawyers. I think we've probably heard about force majeure being declared by the receiver of cargoes of liquefied natural gas under a contract of affreightment. And so just more generally, what are the consequences typically under a contract of affreightment if the contracting party declares force majeure and refuses delivery of a cargo due to the COVID-19 virus? And obviously it's an... the force majeure is an indirect consequence, I suppose, of the COVID-19 virus. But I don't know if the lawyers on the call have any insight into the recent publicity about LNG contract cargoes being refused.
Peter, do you want to go ahead or do you want me to?
No, I'm happy to take this again. I haven't got any direct involvement in any LNG contracts being refused. But again, in many respects, it's going to be the same for any other cargo. You're going to be looking at the contractual provisions and say force majeure doesn't apply as of right. You need to bring yourself within the force majeure provisions. I'm assuming that the cargo receivers that are looking at exercising the, if I heard you correctly, cargo receivers exercising the force majeure provisions, and that they're looking at their particular contracts and looking at the factual landscape and bringing themselves within that. But as I say, it normally results in a delay provision or suspension of performance provision, which may or may not be backed up by termination provisions, which would then lead to relevant losses and claims for breach, etc.
Yeah, I would just only add that we have been asked to look at a few contracts in order to advise as to whether they fall within the force majeure provisions. And so, yes, we do see this as something that obviously is emerging in the market. And yeah, exactly. Again, I agree with Peter that you have to look at the specific mechanism and the result will be exactly the same in the sense of, you know, the analysis. I mean, does it fall under force majeure? And if it does, what does the clause stipulate as being the effect of that? And then you just have to follow that through.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, I guess following up, let's say that an owner has a time charter or a voyage charter carrying cargoes to a port that is affected by COVID-19. And let's say the charter was entered into before this virus was in the news. And the port, the discharge port is, let's say, seriously affected in such a way that the owner refuses to send his ship into the port. You know, what are the range of consequences under a time charter, a typical time charter or a typical voyage charter, and how much do the consequences change depending upon how badly the port is affected by COVID-19? And, you know, how is that decision made?
That's an interesting question and probably a very relevant one. What we're looking at here is an owner refusing to go. So we're going to look through and break this down. He will have voyage orders to proceed to the named port. He's obviously taken a view that there is an issue with this port in relation to COVID-19. So looking at it from a legal standpoint, this brings yourself down two particular channels. The first one, to my mind, is the owner working out, is this a safe port or not? Now, a safe port has a well-known legal definition, and that was established in 1958 in the decision of the Eastern City. The definition, as I say, is well known, and I can quickly recite it. A port will not be safe unless in the relevant period of time the particular ship can reach it, use it, and return from it without, in the absence of some abnormal occurrence. And it's that abnormal occurrence we need to focus on, being exposed to danger which cannot be avoided by good navigation and seamanship. Now, the occurrences aren't necessarily restricted to just physical dangers. They extend to, for example, political and other risks. The question is, and this is the factual question which feeds into the legal position, is how badly is the port affected? Mm-hmm. So if the owner takes the view that the port's unsafe, then that needs to be declared, and the charterer would need to nominate a secondary port. Of course, if you fail to get across the threshold for a unsafe port, then the owner refusing to go there, let's say, for example, the risk isn't as high, then you're looking at breach of the contract in the form of reputatory breach of the charter party, which, if it was to be accepted by the charterer, could result in termination or damages, depending on whether it goes to the root or the heart of the contract. So there's two different ways of looking at it, and each is going to be a function of the factual matrix feeding into different branches of English law. Unfortunately, there's no definitive answer. All you can do is point out that it really depends on the facts, and those facts will give rise to different legal consequences.
And are either of you aware of whether anyone has taken the view that any port affected by COVID-19 was unsafe?
We're certainly looking at it for various clients, but my understanding at the moment on the ground is that there hasn't been anyone actually declaring it unsafe, but that's my understanding. But given the nature of COVID-19, can change on a day-to-day basis, but I'm not aware of any port or anyone claiming that the port is or any port in China and elsewhere is unsafe.
Okay.
Yeah, the same here. I think also just to add a couple of points on that, I think it is so factual based, not only in relation to sort of the circumstances of the contract, but also in relation to how the virus itself develops. And we have seen that in the past with the Ebola outbreak, for example, which may or may not be similar to this in some or other ways. So we will have to see how it goes. But also, I think the courts will look very closely on the actual working practices of the ports and other things like, the type of cargo that is carried, how it's going to be discharged, what kind of contact is expected because of the cargo and other considerations at the port. So all of these things are going to be looked at a very on a very factual basis. And I think the overall... The courts would be in favour of finding that something is unsafe if they're ever asked to opine on that or give a decision on that, and would probably find that a port is unsafe if there was doubt, so that they would resolve in favour of that rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks very much. So a question came in from the audience that I think is probably best directed to Gigo Rivano of IFCOR. And the question is, with phase one of the China-U.S. Trade agreement in place, do you expect trade to increase, or do you think the COVID-19 virus will impact the current agreement? And question two, with the COVID-19 virus already having disrupted the logistical chain of multiple products, with recent announcements, the thought that the epidemic may last longer than perhaps originally expected, how do you foresee the timing of the market recovery, especially directed toward dry bulk?
Okay, that's a very vast question.
Yes.
Thanks for it. Let me try to break it out into pieces. So, first of all, in terms of iron ore, which is the main, the biggest import flowing to China, I am not sure. I'm not into the details of the trade war agreement solution, but I'm not sure there is a huge impact on that front. That's very much related to their expansion infrastructure investment plan. And I don't think the trade war will necessarily change that dramatically. And most of the $200-$250 billion figures that have been floating around isn't related to that, although, of course, there's a ripple effect on it. But I don't think in the short term there is any immediate impact. On the other hand, the coronavirus, if it will carry on and consumption in China will be down, for now estimated between 1-2% more if it persists longer, it will definitely have more impact and more disruption on production and therefore less needs of imports. So momentarily, certainly negative. On coal, is a bit of the same, but of course, China has the big advantage of being a huge producer and therefore could tap into local resources to some extent to manage the gaps. But there again, I don't see huge disruption. On the agri side of things, is a bit different. As I was saying before, China is totally dependent on the protein supply for the country. They've been importing in the range of 80 million to mid 90 million tons of beans in the last few years. That has been greatly impacted by the trade war from the origin where those beans were sourced. And the trade war agreement will change those flows, which definitely has an impact on the ton mile. It's very hard to predict because it will really depend on how they settle things. But as far as China is concerned, they are totally dependent on that import flow. So it's just a matter of from where the soybeans will be coming, and not if they will be coming. And as I was saying, it's very hard to imagine they will find alternative sources for protein consumptions. But the biggest part of the agri, trade war bracket agreement is really related to meat consumption. You know that China comes from now this virus, but there's been something as devastating about a year and a half ago started, which was the swine flu. And that has wiped out a large portion, a significant portion of the swine population in China, which then expanded into Vietnam and surrounding countries. So China has become a lot more dependent on meat imports to replace the swine population that got culled. So that will definitely be part of a big, and the U.S. have been a big winner and beneficiary of that, and that will certainly be contemplated. So to sum all that, in my view, I think the short-term impact of coronavirus has been small so far on the trade flows themselves. There is a pipeline, there are stocks that are actually building up because of the lower consumption in China. But as the flu continue, or as the virus continues and they don't find a solution to it, it will probably deteriorate further the trade flows into China, which is not good for the dry bulk complex. On the other hand, the short-term disruption and negative impacts will create a lot more volatility thereafter because you're going to be creating shortages. You're going to eat up stocks as people will divert and not import into China as it's not needed. You will have a certain year price action where you're going to create shortages. So I think, you know, the short term will be negative, and that's why the markets are pricing that on the nearby. They are very low. But I think that will generate an interesting volatility and probably interesting dislocation going down in the next few quarters. So it will probably be good for traders to have a lot of volatility. And I think in general, the recovery will be very much a function of how long the crisis and the peak of the crisis last, as opposed to a prompter recovery of it.
Thank you very much. So I'm told that Mr. Barcelona of ITF is back on the line. And the second part of the question from the audience that we weren't previously able to cover, and I think this is both for Mr. Barcelona and for the lawyers secondarily. But let's say that a crew changeover was scheduled to be handled via China, and the crew basically refused to handle the crew changeover in China. You know, what from the ITF's point of view should be done? And then I think the second question is, you know, from the lawyer's point of view, what are the legal consequences of that if the crew basically refuse to handle the changeover in China and insist on having it done somewhere else?
Well, thank you, Hamish, and sorry about the problem that occurred earlier. I think that I don't know if you are aware, but there are already a number of flag states that these days have approached the International Labour Organization asking for exemption of one of the clauses of the Maritime Labour Convention that with regard of repatriation. We are sympathetic because it's not an easy situation that we can certainly understand. Certainly, probably with better planning, will be possible to accommodate the request for those seafarers that have already come close to the conclusion of their contractual term with the ship owner. Certainly, we are monitoring, we are working with our social partner to see how this can be overcome.
And any thoughts from the lawyers on any interesting legal consequences? Sounds actually like it might be fairly straightforward.
Yeah, I think that you always need to bear in mind two things. Firstly, the overarching contract, the overarching body of law, and the general ship owner's duty of care to their employees, in this case, the crew members. So I'd be reluctant to dive into detailed legal advice because you do need to look at those different bodies of law. In fact, it would be impossible to give any form of legal advice without knowing further factual basis at which to give it. But I'd just leave it at those three general heads at this point in time from my desk.
Mm-hmm. And, a question about probably voyage charters. Because I think in time charters it's much more straightforward. But what happens if a port is shut down due to the COVID-19 virus and the ship is heading for the port and is turned away from the port because of the presence of COVID-19? Who bears that cost?
Yeah, that is a good question, and we had a discussion with Peter about that earlier as well. I think the risk is here with the charterer, particularly if it was known that the port would be closed or suspected that it would be closed once the charter had been confirmed. And again, that ties in with the point about notice of residence and all of that readiness that Peter was mentioning earlier. It becomes all quite a bit uncertain because you go into questions about designating another port, if that's possible, and so on and so forth, and that's not as straightforward in the context of a voyage charter as it is in the context of a time charter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. So, and I'm just looking at questions that have come in from the audience, I think one interesting question for Giga Ravano, which is, do you see any opportunities for dry bulk resulting from COVID-19? For example, fewer new deliveries of ships, and then when the virus basically dissipates one way or the other, port congestion, government incentives to boost the economy, and some sort of snapback effect on the Chinese and possibly the world economy.
I think opportunities that that one can capture, probably not so easy, but definitely, and this is what I was trying to explain before, I think there will be a catch-up effect, what I call a pipeline effect, where you know you draw down now because of the issue, and then you need to sort of catch up later. Of course, one limitation will be, you know, the world capacity to catch up, because usually industries, ports, corridors of export, the supply chains, are usually maxed out unless you're in an environment that is not in a positive economic trend. But we have had good demand, and generally ports have been maxing out what they could, save for accidents, like, you know, Brazil has lowered exports last year because of the last year and the part of the year before because of the mining issues in Brazil, but otherwise people try to go at max capacities, and every year new capacities are coming on stream to cope with the economic growth of the world. So that aside, definitely I think the short-term pain will be compensated by a catch-up effect of the pipeline, and that will result in volatility. So I think definitely. And it's complicated to read today, and one has to follow very closely. But there will be opportunities for a significant price action on the commodities underlying, as well as on the dry bulk resultants. So difficult to tell and time those things, anticipate the magnitude and the timing of it. But I definitely think these sort of impacts that create a form of disruption will create a volatility effect thereafter. And as you're taking a lot of capacity out of the market in the coming month, that will certainly help creating those volatilities to start with. Thereafter, the commodity action underlying and the impact on stocks and the pipeline will also contribute to it. It's a vast question, and one needs to work on the numbers and crunch numbers regularly to be able to see through those. But I do believe it will result in volatility, indeed.
Okay, thank you. And I guess we're probably coming to the end of our allotted time, maybe even running over a bit. But there's one last question that came in from the audience that is interesting, which is that, charterers and owners are negotiating charter contracts now with the COVID-19 virus in mind, and some charter clauses require confirmation of a COVID-19 free crew and no call in a COVID-19 affected port for at least 90 days, and that's interesting. But I guess the question for the lawyers, do you think there is going to be any change in typical charter contracts going forward as a result of the experience of this epidemic, which is in many ways, different from epidemics that we have witnessed previously?
My view is I think that there is a likely basis for seeing a change within charter contracts. I don't think you'll see it in the pro forma contracts per se. Where I think you're likely to see it is in the various addenda or additional clauses which are attached to the pro forma contracts. If you cast your mind back, we've had SARS and we've had Ebola and various organisations, for example, Intertanko and BIMCO produced various contagious or Ebola type clauses. Given that we've seen these types of events occurring every couple of years, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing them being inserted into charter parties on a more frequent or standing basis. So I do think we are going to see some changes. How long before the next one? We don't know. And that's where the danger lies, is that you need to look at those clauses, because if, for example, you had carried over through the broker an Ebola clause and not taken out. Well, it may or may not work, probably won't work, for the coronavirus as it stands now, interfering with East Asia and other areas. So it's always going to be a function of how you've drafted it. And, of course, if you go too wide, you may be void for uncertainty. So there is a delicate legal drafting issue here. But I do think you're probably going to see some form of mechanism to cater for these types of events creeping into charter parties going forward.
Okay, thank you very much. And, you know, I think that probably takes us to the end of our allotted time, and I think we've covered most of the questions, but I would like to sincerely thank all the members of the panel who thought deeply about these questions and were extremely helpful. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you to everybody.
Thank you.
Nicholas.
Thank you.
Amazing,
thank you.
Webinar. Thank you to everybody.
Thank you.
Can all disconnect.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.